This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Friday, the day before Halloween, 4 days before the election, the day of a freakish snowstorm because, of course, 2020, and also the day for our Week in Review. And today is all about what is at stake right now, from what goes into the ballot box to whether we have this pandemic under control. This week, the candidates, local and national, made their final pitches, from the race for Senate in Massachusetts.
The environment, healthcare, gun safety, Alzheimer's, issue after issue. I have listened to the people of Massachusetts and then I've gone to Washington in order to put the laws on the books to protect families.
I'm not a career politician. I got in because I am concerned about the politics of polarization, particularly from the career politicians like Senator Markey, that we can do a much better job of solving problems.
And the 4th Congressional District.
He's been a Republican, an independent, and a Democrat in 6 years. He's a flip-flopper.
My opponent does not have a single substantive disagreement with Donald Trump.
To the two Massachusetts ballot questions and, of course, the presidency.
Hello, New Hampshire. It's great to be with you on this beautiful day. This is the most important election in the history of our country. The most important election.
This election is the most important one you've ever voted in, whether it's your first or 10th. Ladies and gentlemen, the heart and soul of this country is at stake right here in Florida.
Meanwhile, coronavirus cases are up. Testing is vital. New closures are on everyone's mind, and the holidays are up for grabs. So many decisions to make right now. So what are the stakes? Join the conversation with us. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our panelists this week, we have Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor and now CEO of Verdant Medical, and Ed Lyons, a Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Tito, Ed, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me, and I'm just in from shoveling.
Oh, welcome in! I can't believe you're saying that on the 30th.
Do you mean snow?
Yeah. Have you shoveled yet today, Ed?
No, that'll happen later.
Yeah, me too. Tito, I am so sorry that you had to pioneer that for us. All right, so much seems to be at stake in this election, and in the environment in which that election is unfolding. It feels like things just could not be more heightened. I want to start with what's actually on the ballot next Tuesday. Let's talk about the Markey-O'Connor Senate race, Senator Ed Markey versus Kevin O'Connor. Markey is leading in the latest poll, 65-26. This was a UMass Amherst WCVB poll that came out this week. Now, there's a contested election here. It does seem likely to go Markey's way. What do you think's at stake in this particular race, Tito?
I think the Senate continues to be at stake on the national level, but on the local level, whether or not we're going to actually be aligned with values, morals, and opportunities that are actually going to help the larger group or the smaller group. So I think when I look at this race, I think I do need to self-identify that I actually supported Kennedy in the primary, but I think in this race, what you're going to find is Markey is very likely to be unbeatable. For a Republican in the state of Massachusetts. He's been around a long time. He ran a hard-fought primary, and I think that prepares him to be very strong moving into this general.
So, Ed, I want to talk about the party, the Republican Party, for a second, because we've got this added dimension. So you've got Governor Charlie Baker. He endorses Kevin O'Connor, who is the Republican candidate, while the state GOP seems to no longer endorse Charlie Baker. So who is that endorsement for? Who's it likely to sway, or is it meant to sway? Or is that Charlie Baker just sort of saying to his own party, this is what I believe in?
Maybe Governor Baker just likes Kevin. I mean, he knows him. We're all at this little party we had in Swampscott at Christmas time when Kevin met everybody. Kevin's a good guy. Charlie Baker can just endorse somebody because he thinks they're a good person and they deserve a chance at the office. I don't think it has to be complicated. This is all about national
politics.
But he
doesn't always endorse people, though, Ed. Sometimes he does, sometimes he doesn't. It seems like he made a point to endorse Kevin O'Connor.
Yeah, well, why not? Perhaps he feels that you know, Kevin deserves more visibility by endorsing him. I mean, if it's really a 40-point gap, there's nothing at stake here. Senator Markey will be reelected. I think Governor Baker is just getting behind Republicans that he likes, which is fine.
So, Tito, Markey is arguing that his record and his progressive bona fides are the thing that, you know, sort of make him worth reelecting. O'Connor is arguing, this was really interesting to me, we had him on the show earlier this week, he's arguing that there's value in new blood. You just noted that you supported Joe Kennedy in the primary. That was Joe Kennedy's argument. He said the same thing. And I think that primary showed that maybe all new blood is not created equal in this wave of challengers who are trying to unseat incumbents.
That is true. And I think some interesting things that happened in the Kennedy-Markey race. Obviously, Kennedy polled early, very far ahead. But also, Markey had some name recognition issues in the early part of his campaign. And I think the strength of his campaign was him and his campaign being able to really rework itself, remake himself, and have people know him and know him for positive. So I think I don't think that Ed Markey should have a problem getting reelected and being returned back to the Senate to go down and fight the good fight. And hopefully he'll be there fighting with Kamala Harris as well as Joe Biden.
So, Ed, I know that this is like 17 steps ahead, but I'm gonna ask it anyway. We were talking about the governor endorsing Kevin O'Connor. We have heard in the news that Senator Elizabeth Warren will make her case to Joe Biden that if he becomes president, she should join his cabinet. People are already thinking about who the governor might temporarily appoint to fill that seat if Senator Elizabeth Warren isn't in it anymore. Do we take anything from the governor's endorsement of O'Connor in that light?
No. Let me first say, I think it's really interesting that Senator Warren has spent 2 years trying to get some other job. I feel bad about that. That's unfortunate, even though I respect her. No, I think Governor Baker, he really tries to honor sort of the consensus about national politics in Massachusetts. Most of the time, he sort of agrees with the state about how it wants to project its identity into Washington, D.C. It's very rare that he doesn't honor that. And just because he endorses Kevin right now for the Senate race does not mean that he would pick a pro-Trump temporary Senate appointee to go to Washington. I don't think those two things are connected at all.
So what that race is doing, because we know that Kennedy didn't decide to rerun for the 4th Congressional District because he was running against Markey. Now we've got a race there. Then there you've got Auchincloss versus Hall. That's been an interesting one, especially because the whole race from the 1,000 candidate Democratic primary through what now seems to be what am I trying to say here? It's like it represented the full continuum of political positions you might hold or one might hold in the Commonwealth. That feels kind of healthy to me, Tito. What do you think when you look at that whole race from top to bottom?
It's a very, very interesting race. I actually went to school in Brookline. So I'm not going to throw any jabs at my Newton friends. But I think Auchincloss has, as you noted, has been across the political spectrum. I think he is going to clean clocks here, and I think he is going to step forward and win. But I think the opinions as well as the stances have been pretty much across a broad spectrum. When it comes down to the primaries, that's usually base politics. I think he is going to have broad scale appeal in that district and be able to retain that as a Democrat, as a Democratic district.
So, Ed, I'm going to play a couple of cuts from when we had Jake Auchincloss and Julie Hall on our show. Here is Auchincloss. He's the Democratic candidate. He also registered as a Republican to cast a vote for Governor Baker. So this is actually Julie Hall questioning his commitment to the Democratic Party.
He's been a Republican, an independent, and a Democrat in 6 years. He's a flip-flopper. You know, people can change their mind on certain policies, but to change their whole ideological views, to be honest with you, I am hearing time and time again, people just don't trust you, Jake.
He then cast himself as a pragmatist and really tied Julie Hall to President Trump.
My opponent does not have a single substantive disagreement with Donald Trump. By contrast, I think that this president has been the worst in American history, who has left this country weaker, sicker, poorer, and more divided. And I'm going to work with a Biden administration to help us heal and help us rebuild.
So had they been putting as much daylight between each other ideologically as they can in this race, that strikes me because they also both happen to be military veterans with years of service. Julie Hall in the Air Force, Jake Auchincloss in the Marines. It seems like in a different time, that would have been really important and it would have gotten a lot of traction. Are you surprised that it hasn't? And if that could have been front and center, what might we be focusing on that either of them could bring to the table with that kind of experience?
Well, first about the district, I think if you're going to have this bizarrely shaped district that Democrats created years ago, where you put Newton and Fall River into the same district, you can get unpredictable results. The district should never have looked like that. So that's one reason why someone like Jake can you know, not do as well in the north, but then clean up in the south, which is what happened. As far as these two people, they're quite different. I think that Jake is somebody whose politics have evolved along with Massachusetts. Julia is somebody who is sort of living in the past, sort of an imagined Massachusetts where sort of Yankee Republicanism, you know, can defeat sort of the liberalism that she believes is there. But she's unbelievably loyal to Donald Trump. And people just don't want that at the federal level. None of the federal races are competitive for Republicans anymore. Even in the 9th district around Cape Cod and all that, that we've lost the last that race by, you know, 20, 25, 15 points. So the federal races are simply not competitive anymore. These big cultural issues are more important than military background or policy solutions. Kind of the national politics has sort of dissolved all the differences in the general elections.
So just like the Markey race kind of pointed to the 4th District, the 4th District race points to the ballot questions. There are two of them. Question one is about the right to repair. It has to do with really access to telematics or this wireless information that cars are increasingly gathering and transmitting to dealerships. The second is ranked choice voting, which is also sometimes called the instant runoff. So the 4th District kind of became the poster child for the ranked choice voting issue because there were so many candidates. Jake Auchincloss got, I think it was just under 23% of the vote and became the nominee. We're seeing a lot of big former politicians lining up on both sides, or current politicians, Tito, lining up on both sides of ranked choice voting. Where do you stand on it, and why do you think it's an important question either way for the Commonwealth right now?
Tiziana, are you calling me big?
You are a tall guy, Tito. I have always noticed that about you.
I'm just checking.
Tall man.
Listen, okay, thank you very much. I believe that ranked choice voting or instant runoff voting is exactly where we need to head. I believe that it gives someone's vote the additional power in those second rounds to actually make it as powerful as it should be. And just as the numbers that you just put forward, so someone won a race with 23% of the vote, not 50, because, you know, when you go to campaign school, they tell you 50% plus one, right? Not that, but 23%. And so I think this is an opportunity, and we can ask our friends in Cambridge how it works out for them, because they've been doing it for a long time, for people to actually have a true democracy and to have their votes matter. And it also means it changes people's tone and tenor in a race, because you're not only going for that first round, but, you know, folks who are attacking other folks, disparaging other folks, that changes some of the tone and tenor in these races, because you also will have consideration in a second, third, and potentially fourth round, and so on. So I think it's a very important ballot question. I'm supporting it. And in fact, about an hour, I guess I'm going to go and go online and do my first TikTok ever on this topic.
You've never done a TikTok before.
I have never done a TikTok. I can't believe I'm saying that on an NPR station, but no, I have never done a TikTok.
That's okay. If we're all being honest, neither have I. So.
Okay, 800. I do watch TikTok.
Me too. 800-423-8255 if you want to join this conversation. So, Ed, I want to turn to you about right to repair. This question one, what it would essentially do is add these telematics to the coverage that our earlier right to repair vote created, where that information now, individual private mechanics, et cetera, auto repair shops have access to it. the battle on this, you would think that this is about life and death, you know, cybersecurity and potential stalking and sexual assault versus the little guy going out of business. Are the stakes as high as this debate has made it seem like they are?
Lord, I hope not. I thought we're trying to save the country. Like, I mean, look, I really want people to be able to fix their cars, right? We'll get to that later. So I just think that they're just well-funded sides of this issue. I respect they're having this little skirmish over there in the corner. I think people should be able to repair their cars. I think we have, as a computer programmer, let me tell you, there's a lot of software battles to come in the future. And I think this is one of them. There'll be many, many more: artificial intelligence, discrimination, and AI. There's so many software battles to come in the future. Maybe this is the first one we remember.
All right. So before we shift gears to other things and go to a break, obviously there is this whole other thing going on, which is a presidential race. Something like 2 million voters, or 44% of registered voters in Massachusetts, have already cast their ballots. Now, just for a note for our listeners, early in-person voting officially ends at 5 p.m. today. Tito, is this state really worked up over this election?
Definitely. This state is absolutely worked up over this election. Many of the policies that Trump has put forward have been directed at us when we look at tax policy. And many, you know, as early as I think it was a little bit earlier this week, having Jared Kushner basically say that black people need to try harder, and that's how they can get, move themselves up. As well as jamming a Supreme Court justice down the throats of American people, less than 2 weeks before an election. That is, I believe, why folks are all jazzed up for this election. People are voting early, and folks are making sure that they have vote plans, connecting with folks, because this is, again, not only about the presidency of the United States of America. It's about the health and wellness of the future of the United States of America, with a president who has just simply not done his duty relative to this pandemic, and then a whole host of international issues. So I believe that to be the case, as well as Supreme Court justices in the future. And that's a critical component. And we'll probably get to that later. But that piece, in terms of these lifelong appointments for potentially a 40-year appointment with the person that was just placed on the bench. That is something that we all are thinking about.
We will get to the court later. And just to round out your comment before I turn to Ed, according to the New York Times, the quote is Kushner saying, "One thing we've seen in a lot of the black community, which is mostly Democrat, is that President Trump's policies are the policies that can help people break out of the problems that they're complaining about, but he can't want them to be successful more than they want to be successful." So just to the reference you were making, Tito Jackson, that's the quote from Jared Kushner. So we just heard from Tito what he thinks is at stake in this presidential election. Ed, how do you think about it? What do you think is at stake?
We have to decide sort of what we want our national government to be. I think that we're in a very dangerous place in terms of where our national government is operating. I think things were not great before Donald Trump came along, and I think things are now much worse, and we are polarized to a degree that is very dangerous. So I'm very concerned. I'm hoping that if Biden wins, we can all sort of begin to calm down, walk back from the edge of the cliff, and heal as a nation. That's what I want out of Joe Biden. I'm not into his policies, but I just hope that he just tries to heal the country. It is more dangerous to have 30 to 40% of the country, Trump supporters, thinking the things that they do than it is to have bad policies or laws which could be undone. I think what a nation believes will determine its future. And too many people believe too many frightening things right now.
All right. Go ahead, Tito.
I'm sorry. We could use more Republicans like you, brother.
Let's switch to the courts. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Your reactions this week to the swearing in of Amy Coney Barrett as the next Justice of the United States Supreme Court, as well as the nomination by Governor Charlie Baker of Kim Budd to be the first black woman as the Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. We'll talk about all of it. And again, that number, 800-423-8255. So, Tito and Ed, we have lost a number of prominent justices in the last several weeks. Chief Justice Gantz of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court and Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in the same week last month. And then this week, we lost Judge Juan Turuella, the first Puerto Rican judge to serve on a U.S. Court of Appeals. Now, between that and the more than 200, we looked this up, it's more than 200 judges that Donald Trump has appointed to the courts in this first term. Are we witnessing just a huge generational turnover in the court system, Ed?
Yes. My first thought is we're spending too much time talking about judges at all levels. I think that we've made the courts too important. Too many people are suing each other. We're asking the courts to be legislators. I'm not here in Massachusetts. We have a productive politics here, and I think the courts have their proper role. But at the national level, I'm really upset how often we're talking about the courts and how active they are. I think they will be a tremendous restraint on reformers in the future. So I'm kind of unhappy about it all.
So I'm really intrigued by that. We've made the courts too important. Tito, I want to give you a chance to react to that.
Well, I think the issue is the courts have become so politicized, and so we now look at a Supreme Court with Justice Barrett, who stood up for folks, stood up in a case that essentially a employer called one of their employees the N-word, and she said it was okay. Right. So we have people who are now institutionalizing racism, institutionalizing sexism, and a court that could potentially overturn Roe v. Wade and a woman's right to choose. So it's going to be so critical across the board that there's reform at that level. In addition, when we look at the Donald Trump presidency, out of those 200 folks, many of those people have never actually been in a courtroom trying a case. Many of them are, some of them are even in their 30s, and these are lifetime appointments. So I absolutely agree it becomes a huge issue. The bright, shining light in this conversation is Kim Budd, who is going to be ascending as Chief Justice in the Massachusetts Supreme Court. She is exemplary, and I believe will lead that court in the same vein with the same feeling of justice that her predecessor did. So I'm very excited about that appointment, and kudos to Governor Charlie Baker for that appointment.
So let's stay on that for a minute, because it kind of follows on to Ed saying that he thinks, you know, Ed, you said we're politicizing the courts too much or making too big a deal of them nationally, but that we're in a healthy place here in the Commonwealth. I'm going to just play some song of Governor Baker on Bud when he announced that he was nominating her. Here he is.
She believes in empowering people and building confidence in them. More importantly, during a time that has been immensely difficult, a pandemic that has revealed the painful reminders of our country's continued racial disparities and the tragic passing of Chief Justice Gantz, Justice Budd has embodied calm, steady, and collaborative leadership.
And there's more sound I want to play. So now let's move to Kimberly Budd. And this is about the nomination.
It's very meaningful to me, but the idea of actually just being the chief of the Supreme Judicial Court is more overwhelming to me. So I'm going to have to just work on pulling it all together.
And then she talked about what her first goals will be. One is assuming that she is going to be cleared and will serve. Here she is.
We're in the middle of a pandemic. People in the Commonwealth are in a panic. People are hurting. And we have to make sure that the judiciary is running as well as it can. And that's what I'm focused on right now.
So, Ed, when I listen to this, and I don't have any political party in my head, I'm just listening to people. You're hearing competence, compassion, empathy, focus on the business at hand, humility in the face of the moment. There is something that's just a cool drink of water about all of that happening right now in this minute of just heated chaos.
Yeah, sure. She's like Governor Baker. I mean, she's moderate. She's an unenrolled voter. Baker has packed the court with moderates. Between, you know, them, Baker and DeLeo, we live under a tyranny of moderates in Massachusetts, and it's delightful. She's awesome, but I think picking her is what the moment demanded. I think that we need more Black people in power as a model and to bring their experiences to decisions, and she's absolutely fantastic. So I couldn't be happier. The fact that she said that she's more intimidated by being Chief Justice and being the first Black woman Chief Justice is a beautiful idea. I will never forget she said that, and I'll always respect her for that.
So, Tito Jackson, we talked to DA Rachel Rollins earlier this week, who was excited and supportive of Bud's nomination, you know, her potential appointment to the Supreme Judicial Court. She also reminded us of the reform agenda that Chief Justice Gantz was in the middle of creating when he unexpectedly passed away, that the Supreme Judicial Court had just brought down a couple of pretty big rulings about race and policing. Do you have confidence that she's going to carry that legacy forward and pursue the kind of reform that Chief Justice Gantz appeared to be clearly moving toward in his leadership?
And we will all miss the leadership of Chief Justice Gantz. I had an opportunity to have dinner with him once, and it was absolutely amazing. And I think that level of leadership, that level of engagement. And also, he was someone who you saw him out and about in the community. And there was an availability and connectivity there. And I see that in soon to be Chief Justice Kim Budd. I think she is pragmatic in her methods, but I definitely believe that she believes in civil rights and social justice, and her record shows that. And so I'm really looking forward to her continuing forward. And it will be great that a Black woman runs one of the oldest courts in the United States of America. I can't wait to see her swearing in. We'll probably have to watch it on Zoom, but I can't wait to see and follow her leadership.
And let me briefly ask you both to compare and contrast what you're talking about with how much appetite we're seeing out of the state house for reform right now. You know, for example, the police bill reform has been sitting in the state house since July. The lifting of the eviction moratorium came and went without any action from the state house. Do we have courts that are more reform oriented than we do a legislature, Ed?
It's not the court's job to reform things. It's the court's job to determine people's rights. It's the court's job to right wrongs, to interpret things. So, yes, if cases are brought before them, that they will make the corrections that the legislature perhaps should have. So I don't think the legislature is going to be in a permanent state of lethargy, as we've seen lately. If they do, then perhaps the courts will be more active. But I have confidence in our very productive politics that we're going to get these reforms so we won't need the courts to do it. We're not a state that is constantly asking our courts to make up for failures in our legislative process. So I have confidence that we won't need our new Chief Justice to I'll use the word legislate. I don't like saying that, legislate from the bench. I don't think we're going to need that.
Tito, do you share Ed's confidence there?
Well, I'm frustrated. I'm frustrated at the pace that the police reform bill has languished, as you said. I believe this is common sense legislation that having, interestingly, in the state of Massachusetts, you have to have a license to be a massage therapist, to work in sheet metal, to be a plumber. I think it makes sense for there to be a centralized repository for those individuals who are police officers and could potentially use deadly force, and that we track where they go if they're let go from one police force and moving to another. That just makes sense. I know the issue around qualified immunity has been a sticking point, but none of us, none of the rest of us are able to be covered in those situations in cases where we're kind of not doing our job. But I hope that the legislature will move swiftly to pass this, and then they also still have a significant lift in terms of dealing with the budget outlook, which looks to be kind of snowy when it comes to the future.
So we are shifting gears to talk about the coronavirus, how it's affecting Halloween, increases in cases, calls for new testing, what's happening in schools, and what else are you worried might happen as these next weeks unfold. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. All right. So I want to jump in with Halloween. Because despite the snow on the ground confusing us about this, it's actually still October and Halloween is tomorrow. And it's so weird because mostly what we're talking about is what's not happening. How much does that hit you, Tito? Are you a Halloween person? Are you feeling this loss?
There is rumor that I may have dressed up as the father in Coming to America last year. That might have happened.
No one can say for sure.
So I of course I like the holiday, but I think we have to really think about safety. And we live in a day and age that if we could all literally just hit the pause button for 3 months, it's very likely that we could wipe this thing out. Deviations from that continue to put us in a situation now where we're seeing, 5-6 days in a row where we have over 1,000 new cases. And I do have to let folks know that COVID is real. I had it beginning on March 14th, and it put me down in a way that I've never been put down before. And so it's absolutely critical that we listen and we follow the guidelines, and we stay vigilant relative to socially distancing, masking up, and making sure that we don't, go out at times that we don't necessarily need to go out.
Let's go to the phones just quickly here. 800-423-8255. We've got Dave on the line from West Roxbury. Dave, go ahead.
Hi, Tito. I would disagree with you totally on Halloween. I think it's one of the safer activities that they can still do. You don't let them go trick-or-treating. They're going to have parties in houses, which I agree with is much more of a spreader than going outside with masks on, staying spread out for a couple hours compared to party houses on parties. But that's not the reason I called. I think at some point we have to have the discussion of what are we willing to put up with in order to have some sort of life. Tito obviously is willing to put up with 3 months of lockdown of himself, I guess.
I don't know that he said that, Dave. What are you willing to put up with?
If we can lock this thing down, maybe I'm putting words in his mouth, but are we willing to do that? No, we can't. We cannot do that. We don't want to obviously do what has happened in Europe, but maybe we have to. Maybe we can't control the virus. Maybe nobody can. It's a virus. Maybe what happened, we were told Germany was doing really well, and now they're doing poorly. All right.
So let's take that to Ed. Thanks, Dave. I appreciate it. Ed. Okay. And Tito, I'm going to give you a chance to respond to Dave as well, but I want to work Ed in here after the break. There is this philosophical question that we are hearing about whether or not the virus is controllable. We know that that is now, we heard from Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff last weekend, we're not trying to control it. Where are you on this?
I'm controlling myself and my family, and that's what we can control ourselves, the people. We need policy that helps us understand what to do. We've learned a lot about this virus. 1,000 positive test cases doesn't mean the same thing as months ago. It's different people. We're testing people for different reasons. We've learned a lot about the virus in terms of what spreads it and what really doesn't. Halloween trick-or-treating is not particularly risky if you stay outside the person's house. Indoor house parties are dangerous. I think our roadmap about what's open and closed was developed before we knew what we did about the virus, how it's transmitted. So the situation really evolves. I don't think we can control the virus, but I think we can sort of control what we do to make the virus not spread as much and then continue to lead our lives. There's a tremendous public health cost to staying closed with depression and missed medical care. There's a huge cost in being closed. We have to figure out, and this is what Governor Baker is doing, how can we live our lives as slow as we can while still depriving the virus of the kinds of activities that will really begin to hurt us? So it's hard, but I trust our legislature and our governor.
Tito.
Tiziana, interesting. I didn't answer the Halloween portion. There's a bunch of, and I've seen a bunch of trunk or treat situations that are going on in the city. And as noted, most times people would be outside. So there's a possibility of being able to do that in the right way. But as my colleague just noted, the real issue is what can we do to control ourselves to help out and to care about other people enough to do the right thing. We also have seen multiple incidents. I haven't seen a whole lot in Massachusetts, but nationally with folks not wanting to wear their masks and the like. We have an opportunity if we all work together and are hyper-vigilant over the course of a month and a half timeframe, we could probably bang this out. But if not, it's going to linger, and the issues around economic blows and more and more restaurants as well as businesses that are closing, those things continue to add up and continue to hurt more, and they disproportionately hurt those individuals who are behind in the first place, and also with the issue of housing.
We're going to move into a broader look at COVID and the coronavirus here in the Commonwealth. Because we've been talking about trick-or-treating, I just want to do a little bit of public service here. Here is Boston Mayor Marty Walsh talking to WBUR about how to safely trick-or-treat during Halloween.
People participating in trick-or-treating, we're asking a couple of things. Avoid direct contact with trick-or-treaters by setting up kind of a station outside your house. Trick-or-treat only with immediate family members. Wash hands before anyone handles any treats. Wear a mask. The young people that are out trick-or-treating, even with your costume does not substitute for a mask.
So this caution question, what we do next, Tito, the caller saying, let me backtrack. Tito, were you saying that you think we should shut down for 3 months?
No, that's not what I was saying. But the piece here is that we have to do something, and we have to be vigilant in what we do. And I think we see the Boston Public Schools were recently shut down based on these numbers, and also we are now seeing the city, and I don't know if other cities are doing entertaining, closing down restaurants and indoor dining. Those are very harmful. In particular, the starts and stops are very harmful to the businesses who are just trying to be able to stay open. And so I think there are logical, thoughtful things that need to be done. And I think the mayor as well as the governor have been doing some pretty good work in this space.
800-423-8255. We have Christina on the line from Andover. Christina, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I was just going to say that I'm a high school teacher, and I think that having the students out of school is actually just as detrimental to their health and to their learning. So I just wanted to thank you for my call.
Oh, Christina, thank you for that call. And Ed, Christine is making a point there, and this is one place where the Baker administration and Mayor Walsh have some daylight between them. Just as Mayor Walsh announced, as Tito said, that he was taking high-need learners back out of the classroom because of infection rates. Desi and the governor's administration were saying, unless there is spread in the school, keep kids in the school. They've been aligned on so many things, but not this. And then we have Christina saying she thinks it's harmful to the young people in her high school not to be there. How are you thinking about this? How do we make consistent decisions, or should this just be, you know, every district makes its own call?
Well, I think we're finding out that school is less of a risk than we thought it was months ago. I mean, I think in July we all thought the kids were going to go back, and then the consensus collapsed in August, and then it was all about going remote, and the teachers' union spoke up against it, and you know, everybody really turned against going back. But then Baker was really strong. He stated, no, I think most schools can open. He pushed, and I think he's been vindicated that school is not as dangerous as we thought. More experts are saying it's not as dangerous, perhaps not in every community can open. The Boston Catholic schools, the whole diocese has been open. They have very, very few cases, no hospitalizations, none at school. So I think school can be managed in a way we thought it couldn't be before. So I think school is one of those things that has to come back, because otherwise there's such cost, parents not having their kids at school, trying to get their jobs done, you know, kids having a big learning gap. Everything about this pandemic is worsening our inequality. And this is one more area where the inequality is going to get worse, where rich people have their learning pods and their private schools, and the kids who are the most needy are at home not learning. It's devastating. So I think we, as Baker said, we have to have a preference for getting kids back to school unless their particular district is in really bad shape and school is dangerous. So I want it to be as open as possible as long as the data permits it.
Let's get one more call in here. We've got Roger on the line from Lynn. Roger, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just really frustrated seeing so much focus on cultural issues and things like BLM when I feel like COVID should really be our priority. And I feel like there's a lot of hypocrisy, especially when I drive into my downtown and I see BLM protesters on one side and Trump supporters on another. And everybody knows that it's dangerous to gather in crowds. And I just wish more people were focused on COVID.
Thanks for that call, Roger. Tito, what's your response to Roger?
I guess Roger, interestingly, he started with the BLM side, and there's been Trump protesters who've, Trump supporters who've been out all along. As a black person, sadly, you know, when we look at what happened with George Floyd, when we look at what happened with Breonna Taylor, I don't actually get the opportunity to separate those things because literally those are life or death situations that are happening right before us. So I think it's absolutely critical that people, when they're protesting, are masked up. But people aren't it's not a hobby. For folks, that's literally a life or death decision to put the pressure on municipalities, states, as well as our federal government to listen to Black people when we say, stop killing us. And so those are critical engagement issues that I believe have to continue to occur. And it's not like people wanted or voted for that to happen. This is based on Black people day after day continuing to get killed. In cities, large cities, small cities across the United States of America.
So I want to ask the both of you now, we've covered a lot of ground today. At some point, maybe not Tuesday night, but eventually we're going to have an election outcome. And whatever it is, how do we as citizens of the Commonwealth and in the nation start to come together again to address our immense challenges? Where do we find that path forward together? Ed, how are you thinking about that?
Well, I think, you know, we're Massachusetts. You know, we've developed such a state identity in this pandemic. I mean, we're relying on the federalism where we can do things for ourselves. We have great politics here, institutions. We have solidarity around all kinds of problems. We fixed the failures of the federal government, like with the virus. We stood up testing when the feds couldn't. There's so many things like that. I think we should say we know what works in Massachusetts. We're a commonwealth. We've taken care of ourselves even before America existed. Let's just take what we know, hear what works, and try to just be confident about it and try to bring it to our national politics. I think that would be a great thing we could do.
Tito Jackson, same question to you. How are we, whenever we finally know what happened in this election, what's the path to come together to start working on our challenges together?
I think the path to come together is to do what I saw happen the other day. I was on a call with an organization called the Global Citizen Circle, and on that call were individuals who there was literally someone who was on the call who had formerly been a white supremacist recruiter, and he actually stepped forward. And, you know, they called it from healing, healing divisions, embracing our common humanity. On that same call was a Black woman. Her first name was Belvie, and she had gone to Ghana and walked up stairs where Black women were known to be raped. And those two, and on that same call was a survivor of the Holocaust. Those three people were in dialogue with each other. There were tears, including my own, and there was radical but civil dialogue. And I think we have an opportunity in our time to lead in that way and to talk to each other and not at each other in the way that we continue to do. And I also vote for more Republicans like the guy on the other side of the line where we can actually have real conversations. Because when it comes to this, we have so much more in common than we have in different. And we are inextricably linked, as we can see from COVID. Right. So when it comes down to it, all of us, whether you have money or not, when you have to stay home, that has an effect on your family, has an effect on your community, has an effect on those businesses. So we need to understand that as people and citizens of the United States of America, we are inextricably linked and we all succeed or we all fail together.
Well, on that note, and so grateful to both of you, Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor and now CEO of Verdant Medical, and Ed Lyons, a Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Thanks to both of you.